This meeting is now being recorded.
Welcome everybody to the CCT review team call number 16. Working our way to Vienna bound. So thanks for making the call. Is there anybody that's on the phone and only and not available on the Adobe Connect from a roll call standpoint? Okay, great. And does anybody have any changes to their statement of interest? All right, our first agenda item is to approve the final set of applicant survey questions. And for that, I'll hand things over to Aliza.
Sorry, trouble getting off mute. This is Aliza. Hi, everyone. And thank you, Jonathan. So I wanted to go through the applicant survey, which I shared with you via email yesterday. We took all the comments and edits that you all had suggested, as well as some comments that we had received from the PDP subsequent procedures, PDP working group, and incorporated those into a revised questionnaire that we sent over to Nielsen. And Nielsen took some time looking over it, formatting it, you know, in a way that, they can use it, as well as making some wordsmithing suggestions in terms of, you know, their understanding of how people answer surveys, as well as the logical order of things. And so we came up with what you see before you. I saw a few comments back from the list, this morning, my time, from Megan, Calvin, and Water. So thank you very much for those. I'll work on incorporating those suggestions into the next revision. But I wanted to use this time to just ask if there are any further comments or questions or suggestions so that we may incorporate them and get this back to Nielsen, hopefully by the end of the week. If we do so, we should be in good shape to get at least the survey results, I believe by the end of October. The in-depth interviews will take a little bit longer than that, just in terms of lining them up, getting them all conducted, and then actually writing a report, combining all the different answers. So any comments so far on the survey? Jordan, go ahead.
Yeah, so just a really minor one to start off with. There's the question about the number of applications lodged. Mm-hmm. I think those buckets, especially at the top end, are too specific, I guess. I think the 100-plus bucket only identifies two possible applicants. Mm-hmm. And I think the 50 to 100 bucket might only identify one applicant. And so I think it may be that we just want like a 10 to 25 and a 25 plus or something like that. But I think you guys can probably just look at the dispersion of number of applications per applicant and just make sure that you're not ending up with buckets that only have one or two potential people in them, because then the responses are going to be basically individually identifying at that point.
Yeah, you're right on that. In terms of on the lower end, I mean, we did look at particularly how the applicant pool broke down. So we looked at applicant point of contact because that's who we're, well, in some ways, that's who we're aiming to reach. And this seemed to be the better breakdown. But I'll take a look at it again and see how we might approach that.
Yeah, I think the lower end looks fine. I would just, F and G seem like those buckets are potentially
right.
Tiny.
Okay. Laureen. Oh, do you have your hand up? Now it's disappeared. If not, Jonathan?
You know, I did have my hand up and then I put it down, but I did have one other just general issue to raise, and this actually relates to all the questions I was asking yesterday about the application review process assignment. My comment slash question is, there's question number 6 about the contention sets being resolved, and it just it just strikes me that if the contention set process or reconsideration process in general is something that we want to delve more into, I'm wondering if there's any further questions we want to ask on that topic at this point, or whether that's something for later on. But it just does strike me we're asking this general question, but if we did want to delve into issues of community applications, for example, or any of the other topics that have been somewhat more debated, that this might be a place to do it, that we might want to drill down on that question. But I leave it to the group. We haven't delved into this topic a lot yet, but this question raised it in my mind whether we want to go down that path here.
Jonathan?
Yes, I'm inclined to agree with Lorraine on that point, that I wonder if we need to ask some more specific questions if people answer yes on the contention set portion of this, or else we're going to have to leave it to the in-depth interviews. I mean, I guess it's the other approach. And I realize the survey gets long, and we'd had a conversation on a previous call, and maybe you resolved this in email, but we're asking for some questions for which we already know the answer, and I guess I was wondering if there's any way to pre-populate the answer to those questions for Nielsen so that they don't need to ask them, and did you have that conversation with them so that we could shorten the survey and capture the number of applications they had and things like that, rather than having to ask them that question?
So we did have that conversation, and it is possible. I'm getting some feedback there. Thank you. And it is possible to pre-populate the survey as you indicated. Thank you, Jonathan. So there's a few challenges involved in this. So we would be associating that with a particular email address and a link that would be going to that particular respondent. We think it should be fine to have it maintained with the link. The concern we have is that in some instances we may be actually reaching out to now the registry point of contact and not the applicant point of contact. And that person may be forwarding it on to someone else who may not have been involved in the right in the application process in the same way. The reason we're going about doing this is because the applicant points of contact that we have are now 4 years old. Some of these email addresses may no longer be relevant. For example, I've seen email addresses that are, for example, apple@mycompany.com or application@mycompany.com. So there are clearly email addresses that were created for the application process and may not necessarily still be going to someone's inbox. So we're concerned about actually reaching the right population. To that end, we're cross-referencing these with the registry points of contact and asking those folks to forward it on to whoever is the right person in their company to actually fill out the survey. So the concern there might be this person might have worked on the application for their company, but if they used a consultant and the information we have is for a consultant, they may have applied for many more that had, for example, IDNs in their batch or other identifying characteristics associated with them that this individual may not have had. So we're struggling with the best way to do this and trying to capture the largest population without muddling the back end too much, if that makes sense. I hate to get into the weeds, but I want to give you a picture of why this is a little bit more challenging than it may appear on the surface.
I mean, I guess I kind of understand. I mean, I guess maybe it's the last part of your answer I didn't quite get, because the first part is you don't want to key it off the email address because the email address may no longer be legit.
Correct.
But that email address can still be internal to Nielsen can still be the key for that survey, even if there's another field which is, you know, updated email address or something like that. You can still associate, you can choose something arbitrary, it can be a number or even, but to associate the facts with, for Nielsen, and then they can update email address, separately. So, I mean, that feels like a solvable problem from a data standpoint. The other one you mentioned that had to do with the fact that, sorry, go ahead.
It's not the email address that's the problem, it's the individual it ends up with. So if the original contact was, for example, a firm, and we don't think that's a contact that we can reach anymore, so now it goes to the registry point of contact. The registry point of contact isn't going to have the same types of statistics that the applicant point of contact, that consulting firm may have had in representing multiple different applications. See what I'm saying? It's not a one-to-one match with person. It's not the email address I'm concerned about. It's who that email represents. That's where it gets challenging.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that even if you're talking to a firm, you're going to be talking to the firm about a particular applicant, though.
Well, no.
Do you think that they're talking about number of applications by the consulting firm?
Yes.
I see.
Because we're breaking the list down by the applicant point of contact, not by, for example, the registry parent company.
Okay. Okay, well, that was just a potential solution. I don't want to lose Lorene's point about getting into getting to a couple more specific questions related to contention sets. I just thought it was a way to address the length of the survey and potentially even the accuracy of the survey by pre-populating some things, but if that's not possible, then you can need to do it.
Okay. Megan?
Yeah, thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I just have a question about question number five. The only reason, I'm sure I missed it when I was looking at it before. The second sentence of question five says that a contention set is a set of two or more applications that have been deemed confusingly similar to one another. This includes applications for exact match GPLGs. And so I just wanted someone to double-check that that's the exact and correct definition of a contention set, because I'm supposed to be looking at confusingly similar sets and plurals and singular cases. I've been looking at a number of the cases from the panel. And the cases that I've seen all say that a contention set is not just confusingly similar cases, it includes other contention sets. And there's some cases where a confusingly similar case is brought, and you can't be in the same contention set over the same point. Anyway, it's all very confusing, but I'm just a bit concerned that second sentence is not correct.
So I drew that definition from our website, and I'm trying to find exactly where I found it. But I will definitely double check that.
The quote that I have is on page 3 of the panel decision in the .web case. And it says something quite different.
Okay.
Anyway, if someone can just double check that that's what it is. Because from what it says there, and they're quoting also the requirements, it says that contention set is broader than just a confusing similarity.
Okay. I will check. Thank you for raising that.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
I saw that other hand. Jordan.
Yeah, sorry, a couple quick points. First, just following up on the conversation that you and Jonathan just had about pre-populating information and who we're contacting. Are we going to add instructions? Like, obviously, I think it's obvious that we don't want the consultants answering the survey. We want the actual applying organizations answering the survey. So if we're forwarding the email to the consultants because they're the only contact, are we going to include instructions to the effect that, like, please make sure someone from the entity that actually applied for the TLD is responding or something like that? Because otherwise we'll just get consultants with, like, 10 of these surveys, and they'll answer the same for all of them, presumably.
Well, I'm not sure it was apparent to me that we wanted to exclude consulting firms. I thought we were interested in hearing from everyone who was involved.
So I think, like Fairwinds applied for .Fairwinds, so I assume we would want to get their, have them respond. But if Fairwinds is the point of contact for, I don't know, one of their clients, I would want them to forward it to their client so that we got the response from their client as opposed to the consulting firm. Because, like, some of the questions we ask in here is, like, did you use a consulting firm, right? So it doesn't make any – like, consulting firms would obviously say no to that, whereas the original applicant would.
Well, so I was operating on the assumption that we were open to having the consulting firms or law firms answer the question. If that's not the case, then we need to do some shuffling here.
Yeah, I guess I'd like to hear from other folks, but I certainly would want wherever possible. Like, if I could get no answer versus the consulting firm answer, I guess I'd take the consulting firm answer, but I would strongly prefer to have the organization that actually is the applicant responding as opposed to the consulting firm, especially when we're going to be sending potentially a bunch of the surveys to the same consulting firm, so we'll sort of get a bad concentration of answers if we do that. But I'll wait to hear from other folks. The other quick point I had is there's a question. Where did it go? Number 6 about how is the contention resolved. It includes both private settlement and auction, which leaves the question open of what if you did a private auction? Is that number 1 or number 3? So I think either we should have a specific distinction between private auction and ICANN auction, or we should make number 3 ICANN auction if we intend for private auction to be included in number 1.
That's a good point. I would be inclined to say that number 3 could be an ICANN-sponsored auction and group all of the private settlements together.
I think that's probably the right approach, but I just think we should be clear in the language if that's the intent.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. Megan, I still see your hand. I'm not sure if that's an old hand. So then with regard to, well, I guess there's 2 points we should discuss here. One is Jordan's on whether we anticipated consulting firms or law firms that filled out these applications to answer the survey or not, as well as what types of additional questions we may want to add regarding reconsideration requests and the points that Megan raised. Laureen.
So I would say we do want to capture all the information, but I think it's important we know who we're capturing it from. So perhaps making sure that the person answering identifies themselves as to whether they're the entity that actually applied for the GTLD, personally, or whether it's a consultant that was working on their behalf. Just so we know the perspective that we're getting, so to speak, And if that way, if we have them identify themselves, at least we'll have that information.
Okay. So Jonathan suggests that as a screening question. So I presume that if they answer no, that they're not the actual entity that applied, we would then present them with language asking them to forward the survey to the correct party. Is that right?
We could do that, and if they're unable to do that, we can ask them to complete it.
Okay.
Elisa, are you suggesting that the question about that we already have is 258 would be the one you're talking about using? Or a new question?
I think we would have to redo 258 because 258 assumes that whoever says yes applied in some form, whether they were the expert registry or their club.
That's right.
Their representative.
That's need to be for that purpose, yeah.
So we would probably break this into two questions. Okay. Any other comments on that?
And then I guess to the point of getting all that we can, what do we do in that case? Do we have language that says please forward this and then we terminate, or do we go ahead and collect our answers and hope that in addition to that, what exactly would we do with that screening question, I guess is my question.
Well, I mean, if we're screening out no's, then we'd be terminating. I think it would be difficult to go back and try to reach those people again.
Well, right. I guess the thing is that them forwarding a survey isn't the equivalent of the survey being filled out.
Exactly.
So I guess the question. Sorry.
Yes, that's right.
So do we want to move forward with the knowledge that we're talking to a consultant and hope that in addition the person, I mean, we'll end up with more responses than we have applicants somehow, I guess, but we want to grab their answers anyway, to your point about being interested in what they have to say in addition. I don't know what you were envisioning, Jordan, from a screening standpoint, but do we want to exclude them? It seemed that we seem to be in consensus, we don't want to exclude them altogether. But as Lorraine said, we want to know who they are, so once they self-identify, do we keep going but add the instruction of please forwarding this on to the underlying applicant?
Jordan, I would say a totally reasonable approach would be to add the screening question, and just on that screen include some instructions to the effect of, you know, if possible, you know, please forward to, you know, the organization that applied. However, if they're unwilling or unable, we do accept responses from, you know, firms that provided assistance in the application process or something like that. And then if they say, yeah, I'm a consultancy, continue anyways, then we'll know that and we can continue. Or you can just ask Nielsen for some help with this. I think we all agree that the intent is to prefer that the organization that is the applicant as opposed to the consulting firm applies, then we can work with Nielsen to have them sort of tweak the language to get that effect. And we want to identify, and I guess the other principle is we want to identify whether it is that organization or the consultancy. So the screening question seems right, and we can just include some instructions in the screen.
Okay.
I guess I'm just asking a logic question, Jordan. If they are consultants and we present the thing that said, can you forward this along to the underlying applicant, do we still want to proceed with the consultant, or are you going to try to have them in? I mean, they're not going to be able to, while taking the survey, the question about whether the applicant is willing to take the survey, I don't think. Do we proceed with the
right,
with
so I would say that the instructions would be roughly, you know, maybe on the very first screen or in the email we send out or something like that, it can say something like, you know, we prefer the responses come from the original organization or something like that, but if that's not possible, then we accept this. So maybe those instructions don't go on that screen and they come earlier, either at the first screen or in the email. And then we could put a reminder in the screening question. And then presumably they bail out if they haven't made that attempt already.
I guess I'm just concerned that could lead to a bunch of no answers, because if they forward it under the belief that the applicant will throw it out and then they don't, and then they've bailed out of the survey, then that becomes a no answer. Am I missing something?
This is Alisa. I think you're right, Jonathan. You might end up with a lot of non-answers. I'm also concerned about allowing them, for example, allowing the firm to answer, and then also allowing them to forward the email on and having someone else answer the same link. They're connecting, Nielsen will be connecting, I think, ultimately the link with all of our back-end information, so it could start kind of muddling who's actually answering, and we could be getting multiple responses to the same survey from the same, ostensibly the same party.
Presumably, because of the screening question, you'll be able to tell the difference between those two.
That's the theory. At least I guess I don't understand the implications of.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I guess at least I don't understand the implications of what you're saying in terms of. it feels like I just assume get two responses related to the same application rather than zero.
If you don't have a problem,
I guess that's why I would say.
It's certain. I agree we shouldn't kick people out at the survey at the screening question because we want to allow them through. I just think we should provide instructions somewhere saying we prefer that you, if you're getting this and you're not the actual applicant, we prefer you forward it on to them.
You can always So that's in the email, Jordan, so that means they don't fill it out then, and we don't know whether or not the applicant will fill it out. I guess that's the only concern.
Sure, but the alternative is that we just get this. Consultancy is filling out essentially all of the responses.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I guess we ask them to pretend to be the applicant. I feel like it's a better problem to have two parties fill out the same application than to have no parties fill it out. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
I agree with that. I guess I'm just struggling. So you think what is likely to happen if we don't include the instruction I'm suggesting, is that the consultancy will get it, forward it to the applicant, and also fill it out themselves. Like, I just, I don't understand why they would do both of those things.
I guess the instruction I'm suggesting is one that suggests that they do both, as opposed to saying, hey, if you're not the underlying applicant, forward this along and forget you ever got the email. I guess, is it possible for that instruction to say, could you forward this to the applicant as well as filling it out, or something like that? I guess that's what I was getting at. And then later on, we screen based on the screening question about whether or not they're a consultant or the underlying applicant. It just seemed like the instruction you were putting out there, Jordan, just leads somebody to forward an email and forget about it, and then we don't know whether, then we may not get any response. That's all.
Yeah, well, so maybe an approach, maybe the best approach, there's a relatively small number of consultancies that cover a relatively large number of applicants, and so maybe an approach is just to talk to them sort of in advance or while we're sending out the survey so they are sort of aware of what we're after, as opposed to just relying on the instructions.
That sounds very smart.
So we talked about Erwin, a couple of losses, yeah, 2% of the consultancy.
So if I can just add, I think for all of the TLDs that are now delegated, so we have 1,200 or plus that are delegated, what we're actually hoping to do is use our registry point of contact as the first person we'd like to reach out to and ask them to forward it within their organization to who the best person is. I think in that instance, the bulk of the applications will be covered because, you know, we have a contact that we know to be recent and valid, not 4 years old, and we'll get to someone within the organization. We're also planning on reaching out to all the registries beforehand to let them know that this is coming, and that we're planning on fielding the survey, that this is for this review, and it's an important piece of research to shed light on the application process. So, I think to the extent that there were withdrawn applications that came from consulting services or law firms, I think that's where we might have a little bit more challenge in reaching someone if that's the only contact we have for those applications, but it may be a smaller pool than we're thinking.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. We're sending to the registry contact wherever we can and trying to get them to find the person that was involved in the application process. And then if the only address we have is for the consultant, we can say, ask them to forward it, and maybe to Jordan's point, you know, give a heads up to the consultants and say that we'd like to get to the underlying applicant if we can, otherwise it's okay for them to fill it out.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments on the survey?
Sorry, before we move on, Jonathan, I also wanted to address the issue of additional questions on contention and reconsideration requests. Perhaps Megan or you or others can send me some suggested questions. Our timeline is tight, so if possible, I'd like to receive them by tomorrow, Thursday.
Okay. I'll give some thought, and Laureen, if you would as well, let's try to get some questions to Lisa that can boil down to a few additional questions on contention sets.
Can I make a proposal then?
Yes.
Yeah.
Should we just exchange amongst the three of us or four of us or whatever the number we are, the proposed questions, because we may all say the same thing? Or instead of bombarding poor Elisa with 20 times the same thing, what do you think?
I just think the time is tight enough that Elisa can filter the duplicates rather than waiting for a two-phased approach, that's all.
And this is Laureen, just for clarification. I think that my question was a little broader than just contention sets, which are the confusingly similar. To me, the broader issue is the process to resolve disappointed applicants, I'll put it that way, because it's not just contention sets. This, we could presumably also use this to delve into issues regarding reconsideration or community applications, those types of issues. You know, basically, where applicants are asking for another look about their application, which is broader than just contention sets.
That makes sense, Laureen. Is there a question that we can hang a hook on to ask those questions? Or do we need a screening question to get at that notion other than just an?
I'm thinking maybe we need a screening question about did you seek reconsideration of your application? Something to that effect, because that would allow us to drill down to issues surrounding any reconsideration process, whether that involved an independent review panel or reconsideration at the ICANN level. I know there's several tiers.
Okay, so then that's a so do we change 5 to be a reference to a reconsideration and then make a new 6 that says what type of reconsideration it was and then another question about how it was resolved? I guess the resolution question is might not apply to all the different things, though. Go ahead, Megan.
Sorry to jump in, but I was just going to say, you could make it an open-end question to say, how was it resolved? So they give you the exact answer. Because there may be many different cases. We may have had a whole series of contention. The contention set is a slightly different issue. But you may have had a whole series of recourse against a decision that you didn't like or didn't agree with. So should
we leave these two questions alone and just have another pair of questions about reconsideration?
Let's do that. I think that's much better. Instead of redoing all these.
So we don't lose the coding on these?
In number 5, that sentence has to be slightly changed.
Yeah, please, Megan, I guess counting on you to come up with that language that you said you found and get that to Elisa, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I put something in the chat, but I'll send it by email. That was just a rough and ready.
So then what we're talking about doing here is just inserting 2 more questions right in this spot, which is whether or not you had requested a reconsideration on the outcome of your application, yes or no, and if yes, then an open-ended question about how is it resolved.
And this is Lorene again, and then perhaps that would allow us at least to consider interviewing those folks if we're interested in particular challenges regarding the reconsideration process.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Try to get to those two questions. Let's move on to the research updates. Oh, go ahead.
Thank you. That's all I said.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's move on to the research updates, please.
Sure. Thank you. So the economic study draft report is nearly done. We'll be sending that along to you before you all depart for Vienna. And Greg Rafer from Analysis Group will be with us both days in Vienna to go through those findings as well as some of the additional work they did at the request of the competition sub-team. I'll also be receiving before you leave for, you'll also be receiving before you leave for Vienna the registrant survey results. There should be forthcoming probably by early next week. On the research that AM Global is conducting for us on the developing country cohorts, I know they're well underway with their interviews in various regions, so I think they are on track to provide you with a report by the end of September, I believe. And the last piece, of course, is the applicant survey, which we just discussed. On the DNS abuse RFP that we put out, I'll defer to Brian to give you a quick update there.
Yeah, thanks, Aliza. We've had submissions of interest from three groups, one we know well, one we kind of know, and one we don't know at all. So it'll be interesting to hear what their proposals look like. And this week I'm in the process of answering their our questions on the RFP, sort of clarification questions. That will be finalized by Friday, and we're have a deadline to have the RFP proposals in by the 25th. So everything's moving along on that. So happy to answer any questions, but that's all I have in the way of update. Thanks.
I think that covers all the topics.
Thank you.
Okay, any questions? I'm very curious about the results of all of them, so thanks for the update. Okay, on the road to Vienna, the Safeguard Bus Roadmap. Do we hand that over to Lorene? Go through.
Thanks, Jonathan.
So we had a very good phone call yesterday, which made me feel that our map is emerging. Basically, we have divided our set of issues into several discussion papers that map some of the sub-issues that we are tackling. Right now, the paper's number 11, and they deal with the broad issues of impact of DNS abuse, impact of safeguards and public interest commitments, consumer end-user behavior, and effectiveness of procedures to enforce the safeguards. And then there are several papers within those categories. We have teams of three working on each paper. Those teams have been conferring and collaborating, and we have drafts due for those papers to be circulated on the 22nd. And our roadmap for Vienna is to get those drafts circulated on the 22nd and provide one another with feedback so that we can circulate these 11 draft discussion papers to the entire review team by the 26th before Vienna, so that optimally folks will have an opportunity to look at these papers. In Vienna, we will plan on having each paper getting presented by a sub-team member, a brief presentation, because the premise will be that folks have already read them. And these aren't going to be really long discussion papers. In fact, I think most of them will be two or three pages. But they will set out a high-level question with additional sub-questions that would need to be answered to get at the high-level question. They will contain findings that map to the data that we've been collecting. Some of it will include the data that's already been generated, such as the Nielsen survey. Other may be data that we've come across in our readings. But it will contain specific findings that relate to our sub-questions, some analysis of potential causes that relate to answers to the questions, and then some draft recommendations and suggestions for how one might review the topic in subsequent reviews. The aim of this approach and this template is basically to really get us thinking about what the specific findings and data are that relate to our bigger questions, and then allow the group to get into a discussion of those findings and recommendations. So really our first step in along the road of developing recommendations on these topics. So that is that's the basic roadmap. And all of our discussion paper topics are on the wiki. So if folks are interested in what is coming up, they can see all the discussion paper topics listed. There are 11 of them thus far. And I think the other thing to keep in mind is that we see this as an evolving process, so there may be more discussion papers in future, and these recommendations are basically our first thoughts on issues. They're not going to be our last thoughts, and we're hoping that Vienna offers an opportunity for us to get the entire sub-team thinking about these issues and providing their perspective. I'm happy to take questions or provide more details if folks are curious about more specific sub-issues. Or process questions.
Irene, this is Jonathan, and I guess this is an open question, which is, do you envision these reports back just to be to the sub-team or to the greater review team? I guess we need to think about what our roll-up process is in terms of everyone seeing the findings, and maybe these discussion papers are going to be too preliminary for the group as a whole to begin to comment on them. I don't know, but do we need a mechanism to report out, the work of the sub-team to the to the general team and the presentation of these findings. It feels like Deanna is a good place to do that, but maybe it needs to happen after the subteam has had a chance to digest them.
Yeah, I think you raise a good point. I need to give that some thought. Honestly, at my first inclination was thinking that Deanna might be an opportunity for the entire subteam to comment on this, but maybe that leaves a little bit insufficient amount of time for the subteam to be able to coalesce on its own about these issues. And I guess that that gets to the broader question of the agenda for Deanna and how much time we have together as a review team as a whole devoted to our particular sub-team issues, so to speak. I know we have time together as a, I know there's a lot of time together as a sub-team, but I'm not sure how much time there is together as a review team to devote to consumer trust issues, so to speak, which to me is what your question gets at.
It does indeed, and one of the things that we need to, you know, finalize, I think, today, if we can, is what the agenda for Deanna should be. So that, I'm interested in people's feedback about whether or not the circulation of these discussion papers at Deanna is sufficient, or do we do Adobe Connect, PowerPoint presentations about findings for the group as a whole, and do it as just one of our calls in September. I'm interested in people's feedback on how we roll up to the greater review team the work of the sub-teams. If everyone's in consensus that we should just focus on sub-team work primarily, in Deanna we can do that. We just need a mechanism then to share more broadly afterwards. So I'd be interested in hearing people's feedback on that particular issue. Nobody has an opinion? Because I believe the agenda as it now stands does not leave enough time for roll-up presentations by the sub-teams to the, I mean, they're just very high-level summaries, but actually delving into findings and getting Q&A from the group is not going to happen on the current agenda. Is everybody okay with that? Jordan, go ahead.
Is our timeline after Deanna, I guess. How okay I am with that, I guess, depends on what we expect to happen between Deanna and when we publish the draft report.
Well, and to some extent, it's circular because the answer to that question will be somewhat dependent on what we do in Deanna, but presumably the next phase would be to begin to draft these discussion papers into preliminary findings so that we can, by the end of the year, share, at the very least, some preliminary findings for public comment. So we can build into that process, you know, very, very quickly after Deanna, if we want, in September, to say that we need to devote time on plenary calls to the presentations of high-level questions or something like that by team leads within the sub-teams on the greater group, and that people throw together three or four PowerPoints and have to sort of share the findings and the underlying data. I mean, we will obviously have circulated all of these things for people to read, but the question is getting at that interaction might still be valuable, so we could just make a decision that the very first thing we do after Deanna is a presentation of these discussion papers to the broader group. Laurie, is that a new hand?
No, I think it's still an old hand, but I think that that approach makes sense. And I see, some discussion in the chat that folks would like to focus on the sub-team work in Vienna, especially if time is short, and that makes sense to me. Perhaps I was a little bit too aspirational to think we would have time to approach it within the big group. Eventually it has to percolate to the big group so we all can weigh in. But I'm comfortable with keeping the sub-team focus in Vienna and keeping it as a high-level report to the group as a whole, with the intent that we follow up in September to percolate this information to the review team as a whole, so we do get that discussion going.
So, Alice, I guess let's just revisit the work plan and make sure that the schedule, the call schedule and things, and make sure that the first thing that we do in September is have these individual team leads actually present their find a broader review team via the Adobe Connect. Little micro webinars. Thank you. Any other questions for Laureen? One thing I guess I wanted to myself ask Laureen is some people know, but others may not, that based on a couple of conversations with Laureen about what I meant in the worksheet and some confusion around that, Laureen has reconstructed the worksheet and Jamie's concerns about hypotheses having embedded bias and things like that. Laureen has reconstituted the worksheet to be more question-based, and so it looks like it's now up on the screen. So I just wanted to, maybe I'll just even ask Laureen to walk us through the structure of this and see if people have questions or comments on it, because I'd be just as happy to standardize on this version of the worksheet as on the one that I did, if it makes more sense to folks. So let's, Laureen, if you would, why don't you just walk through this briefly and talk about how you filled it in, and we'll get any feedback, because I think we may just want to use this going forward, so again, so we have a consistent presentation of information.
Sure, happy to do that. So basically, this is a slight reworking of the template that Jonathan had put together. And what generated this is that some of us were struggling with the notion of a hypothesis, which is typically a sort of affirmative statement. And as these were getting formulated, there was some concern expressed that the statements were, rather than being objective, susceptible to a yes or no answer, were, as we say in the attorney parlance, leading questions, suggesting an answer or a point of view, when really our job is to, ask questions and see what the data provides with an answer. So basically, I just tweaked things a little bit so that it would be a template for us to ask questions in an objective manner and to be mindful of that. And also to make sure that our template labels the high-level question that we're concerned about just for clarification purposes, that that's our start. So if we look at this sample worksheet, this is one of our big high-level questions in our consumer safeguards sub-team. Do consumers trust new GTLDs? That's one of our big high-level questions. So the next part, of course, identifies whose discussion paper this is. That's important so we can have follow-up and ownership identified. And then there are a set of sub-questions. And the thought behind that is, if you are going to answer the question of do consumers trust the new GTLDs or to what extent consumers trust new GTLDs, what do you need to get at to answer that question? And the important highlight here is you may not realize what you need to get at until you actually look at the particular data source. And that's something I've emphasized with my sub-team. So it's important to review the data as you are formulating the sub-questions. Certain sub-questions are maybe intuitive, and you can come up with them right off the bat. But the data is also going to inform your sub-questions. So you see, one of my first questions is, why do consumers visit TLDs? That's not necessarily an intuitive question, but it turned out in reviewing the Nielsen data that one of the big factors for trusting a GTLD was familiarity with the GTLD. So that's why that sub-question was formed, and I just use this as an example to show that sometimes the data is going to generate a sub-question. And then there's a list of other sub-questions that feed into this bigger issue. For example, do consumers trust new GTLDs as much as legacy GTLDs? Then some behavior questions, do consumers provide sensitive information? Do consumers trust new GTLDs that offer domains two, and then there's a list of precautionary measures, and then a sub-question, do restrictions on who can purchase domain names contribute to consumer trust? So all of these questions feed up to that big question of do consumers trust new GTLDs? From this point on, the template is actually similar, if not identical, to what Jonathan had originally proposed, listing findings, and I've mapped these findings to the questions so that finding one relates to question one. I think that's important because you don't want to have a problem figuring out what your finding relates to. And you'll see I've also identified the source and the particular pages because we all may be wading through a lot of data. And you do want to keep note of where your data is found, because that'll be very helpful for the final report when we, I'm sure, will have extensive footnotes and references. After findings, there's a list of causes. These are, I think, the analysis that is going to come from the particular findings in question. They're probably, this is probably going to be a topic that is going to be the subject of a lot of discussion, because I don't think in general that there's going to be one specific cause or agreement on one specific cause. So these are, preliminary thoughts and analysis on what the data shows. A priority to address, we have that because we had spoken about, our preliminary findings and what's going to be most important. And when we make recommendations, that it's going to be important to address how prioritized these should be, what should future entities really address first, and then the recommendations themselves. And you'll note that these should be identified as to who the recommendations are directed to. So is it going to be directed to the staff, the board, a subsequent procedure PDP, which is going on, the nature of a recommendation, implementation details, exceptional costs, et cetera. Again, you know, for now, I think these are going to be fairly preliminary. And then how you can review these recommendations, that's the last part. So much of this is Jonathan's original template, and basically I really tweaked the beginning part to make sure that we're asking these questions in an objective manner, and also that we're thinking of them in terms of what is our high-level question and what do we need to answer to get at that high-level question. Happy to take questions or comments.
And more specifically, is there anyone that doesn't think that this format would work for them? Silence is consent, along with Jamie's actual consent. Any other questions about this? All right, Lillian, thanks for your work on this, and let's try to use this template for our discussion papers and our discussions, and we will morph this as necessary, but let's make this the template for the discussion papers going forward. Well, just so thanks, Aline, and next on the agenda is Jordan talking about the competition and choice roadmap.
Sure. I will be relatively brief because I know we've still got quite a bit of other stuff to talk about. The competition and consumer choice team got a bunch of new data over the past couple of weeks from analysis group on several of the projects that we've assigned them. And have also made some progress, I think, in trying to get parked data. So we're getting, I think, we're now at the phase where instead of focusing on what data we need, we're starting to receive data and being able to chew through it. And I'm hoping that in Vienna we'll really be able to have discussions focused on interpreting that data. We have about five of our projects with data received from analysis group now, and I expect a couple more by the time we get to Vienna. So I'm in the process and a little bit behind on sort of mapping that to individual questions and trying to assign it out to team members as Lorraine's team has been doing so that people can take a look at it and report back to the group in Vienna. Hoping to have some updates on that later today, and we'll be having our call next week to discuss where we should be able to have a bit more discussion around the individual projects and how we're proceeding to Vienna. I think that's probably. That's probably all in terms of an update. We are also need to sort of the other thing that we've been talking about is that Stan has put together a couple of write-ups of translating some of the research projects into prose, sort of which takes the next step beyond the templates that Jonathan's put together and Lorraine's amended. I think that's probably worth some discussion in the future as well, but probably what we want to do is get to the point where we're pretty happy with one of the templates and then try to turn that into a little bit of a chapter or something like that using Stan's approach to translate that into prose. So I'm hoping that actually we'll have time to do that with at least one of these projects before Vienna as well. And then one of the discussion topics that we could have either in Vienna or shortly thereafter is what our approach is going to be as we start to digest completed findings and how we're going to sort of write about the data and what the findings are. So fortunately, Stan's done some great work there that will help inform that, I think.
Thanks, Jordan. Any questions for Jordan on their roadmap? All right, then let's move to Alice talking us through our agenda.
Hi, Jonathan. Thank you. And so, as you both see in the Adobe Connect pod right now, and there's your copy in your inbox as well, so we've assembled a draft agenda for consideration. For this meeting, observers will be invited to join you in person as well. And there will be a dedicated slot on day one at the end of the day for a brief exchange with them, so an hour. So the night before, you'll be invited to a welcome cocktail on Sunday. And observers are also welcome to join you for that cocktail, and we've asked them to RSVP for that. So day one, we'll be focused on receiving updates from Nielsen on the registrant survey and the Q&A. There will be a brief overview from the economic study, and then we'll dive into the application evaluation process discussion. After lunch, you will be spending part of your afternoon in a breakout session. The Competition Consumer Choice and Safeguards and Trust will have 2 hours on day one in the afternoon to go through their findings and papers. And then we'll resume again with the application evaluation discussion and then end the day with the meeting observers discussion. On day two, we'll start with another breakout session again that will run until the coffee break mid-morning, and then we'll start again, resume again, until lunchtime. And in the afternoon, there was a slot here for both sub-teams to relay their findings to the full group, but that probably needs to be revised based on what you've just discussed. And we'll end the day with an overview of the draft report structuring framework that Jonathan and I are working on. And of course, the meeting will conclude with the establishment of the work plan, next steps, and a recap of all the action items. So this is just a draft, and open to any comments or input you have. I'll get back to you, Jonathan.
Just put the two of you in touch.
So I'm not sure if there are any questions or immediate feedback on this.
Alice, it's Lorene. I have a question. Do we know how many in-person observers are expected?
So we released the blog post, the announcements yesterday, and we started collecting. I think we've received 2 RSVPs to date for the cocktail. So it's local stakeholders who are in the region who've signed up. I know George Sadowski from the board, the ICANN board, will be attending the meeting as well, and that's about it. So we'll keep a list of people who sign up for the event, and we'll share that with you as it becomes available.
So that's helpful. I'm just wondering about the time devoted to the discussion with the observers, if there are very few observers if that is a if an hour is the right amount of time, whether it should be perhaps shorter if there are fewer observers. But I leave it to the group.
Thank you, Lorene. So that time slot is currently at the end of the day one, so I'm sure we can end the meeting earlier or go back to another topic if we need to cut it short. But I will leave you, I will leave Jonathan and others to.
And the only other question I had was for the, and this is probably for Jonathan, is for the application and evaluation process. At least speaking for myself, those issues haven't been at the forefront of my focus, and I know I'm in desperate need of a reminder about what the to-dos are and expectations are. So I'm thinking that I might not be alone, and that we would all benefit from a little more information about how we can best prepare for that.
Thanks, Lorene. I will. I'm working on dividing some things up and making more explicit instructions that I hope to get out in the next day or so here. That should clarify. I mean, a lot of this is going to be presentations of outside findings that are going to provide the actual data. So I mean, there's only a few instances in which we have the data already for the discussion papers, but I'm going to try to put that together in one document here in the next day and a half, basically.
Thanks, Jonathan.
And on the other question about the open session. Obviously, there was some interest by a couple of the observers to have a way to participate, and so at some level, that is probably by buttonholing team members during breaks and things like that. But we decided to come up with a kind of a dedicated session so as to make clear that the entire session wasn't open to participation by observers. And I guess I'm inclined to agree with Alice that. We'll probably be running late anyway, and we can end early, and I don't think there's a need to necessarily shorten the time for this right now in the agenda, but I again welcome other people's feedback.
Let's play it by ear. We'll see how long it takes and how many show up.
Thanks, Megan. That's my explanation as well. Is there anybody else that has an opinion on this? Hopefully my objectives are clear. Okay, any other questions with the agenda? Then let's move on to some of the conversations that we've had going where there is some underlying spot a little bit to discuss the reading that she's been doing lately with related to GAC advice and reconsideration. I confess I don't know what I meant, what we meant by this first, by little A here, so perhaps Alice, you can clarify, what report we want to make from the working group, the correspondence between the two of them. So this was in, Megan's, hands as well, so I don't know, Megan, can you, give us a little overview of your findings?
Yep, happy to. So in terms of the correspondence between that and the new DPLD system.
Be sure to speak into the microphone.
I'm speaking great big screen, is that right?
You were fading off as you were speaking.
Sorry. Let me try checking my screen. Maybe that will help. So there's been an exchange between the GAC and the new GT Obstacle Procedures CDP. Quite frankly, it's not too dramatic. It's a kind of bounce back and forth. Don't do anything until we finish our reviews. Make sure you take into consideration GAC advice in anything that you do, et cetera, et cetera. So both sides are saying, don't worry, we're not going to do anything until everything is all clear. So I'm not too worried about little a there under 5A. I think it's quite clear the existing applicant guide hasn't been proposed yet to be changed, although we know that there's some aspects that probably need some tweaking and adjustment. And I think there it's just a question of the GAC and the working group clarifying how they're going to work and what's going to happen. So that's on little a. I think that's quite a minor point. Thank you. On B and D, which are the two others that I've been looking at, I've sent you a little note about GAC advice. This is early warning advice primarily and new GTLD application. And the problem is that the numbers look quite inflated, because if you take the cases of GAC early warning, let's say in the case of .GmbH, which is the one that one of those that I identified in the little note here, there were 6 GAC early warnings. But there were also 6 applications, and they're all for the same stream. So, of course, 5 of those were withdrawn because they came to an agreement amongst themselves, and 1 went forward. So we can't say that the GAC early warning advice was the cause of withdrawal. It was the contention that caused the withdrawal. On the other hand, the GAC advice did mean that there was a pick associated with the final verdict. So what we were looking at theoretically initially was, did GAC early warning advice lead to withdrawal? And I really can't say that there's a clear cause and effect there. What it did do in this particular case was make sure that the pick was included. The pick is the public interest commitment. And in that case, it was to make sure that any registrants who used .gmbh really were registered, legally reliable organizations that have the .gmbh accreditation, which is like being a limited company or a limited corporation in U.S. law or in other legal jurisdictions. It has a particular meaning. It's a kind of limited company, limited liability company. So that's what happened there. So I went through them all, but it's really very, very difficult to say, with a couple of exceptional cases, and those cases are still on hold, where GAC early warning advice did make a change. So I wrote about the case of .Swiss, which was a geographic name. The Swiss Confederation contested that. Swiss Airlines wanted to apply for it, and so did the Swiss Confederation. So that was GAC early warning advice from the Swiss Confederation saying, sure, you can't use it. So Swiss Airlines withdrew. That's a clear case. And then in the case of .Islam and .Halal, those are on hold, because of the comments that were made by the government of India, which said that, and of course, this is an interesting little fact, wasn't in the GAC early warning, but India has more Muslims Pakistan in terms of sheer numbers. So, well, there are all sorts of political issues going on in India as well, as you know, but their concern was that using Islam or Dalal would have regional or territorial considerations, and so the whole thing is on hold. And then there were a number of cases, as I said, also on geographic cases. So I think it would be very hard to draw a conclusion that GAC early warning led to the withdrawal specifically of any cases, except where there was either a geographic name and possibly some religious or other contentions, like the Islam or Halal cases. And again, they're on hold, so they've not been withdrawn, all of it. So that's where we are on that case. You want me to continue on to string confusion? It's even more confusing than Dacadai. Or do you want to ask questions?
Yeah, let's open it up for questions. I guess one of my early comments, Megan, is that I'd love for you to take a shot at filling in the template that Lorene created with respect to this question about the effectiveness of GAC participation, and look at some of these things as sub-questions and try filling in that template just so that we're all reading things in the same way and the references are there and things like that. I'd really appreciate that. But also I'm happy to, it'd be great to open this up for any questions people have about these findings.
Okay, I'm happy to fill out the template if someone sends it to me again. Because I've got so many templates, I'm not...
I understand. So Alice, please make a note to make sure that Megan has this modified template from Lorene. I guess we should make sure it goes up to the whole group as well. Any questions for Megan? Megan, what about things like .wine and as examples? Were those, again, things where there were just multiple entries and it makes it tough to control the variables?
No,
I mean, some of these were pretty comfortable.
Yeah, .wine and .va is a separate case. And that, there was, of course, the GAC early warning advice. And David knows this intimately because he and I worked on this in a lot of detail. But it didn't result in withdrawal. The argument that we made was, did GAC early warning result in withdrawal? It did result in a kind of public interest commitment. Let's call it a pitch. It's not, it's even more complicated than a pitch. And special provisions written in, it went also to an ICAM, no, private auction. It went to a private auction. And the GAC early warning advice did have an influence on the final pick, let's call it a pick, that was developed, and the way in which .wine and .da were ultimately settled. And, of course, from an ICAM perspective, I don't think this made any difference in the delegation, in the contract. It just slowed the whole procedure down. We did have, I've forgotten now what this particular acronym is called, an RIT or a PRI or a community contention. I've forgotten exactly which procedure we went through. I'd have to go and look it up in my files, but we went through a whole series of different procedures, and that certainly delayed the process, rightly so, because it had to be settled. But there was no withdrawal as a result of that. And that was a question you were asked to look at. there were certainly a whole series of, let's call them public commitments that were engaged, entered into, and a whole series of special provisions that were added to the delegation of those two. And that was directly related to the gas index, no question about it.
Which is one of our questions as well. So, I mean, I guess we can capture both. The withdrawal isn't the only issue. It's just
it's not the only issue, but it was the prime.
It's just one of them. Sorry, your voice faded out again, Megan?
It was the primary question that we were asked to look at. Did GAC advice lead to withdrawal? That was the primary question we were asked to look at. But, of course, GAC advice did lead, as I said, to introduction of PIC, to some cases being put on hold, as I said, in geographic cases, in .wine and .nas, a whole series of negotiations that took place to protect both consumers and producers of wine. So there's certainly qualitative and some quantitative. Not specifically on withdrawal, except for the geographic region.
Okay. I guess this is part of why the template will prove useful, Megan, because obviously the high-level question is just about effectiveness of the process for Jack advice, and these are some of the sub-questions underneath it. So if you can take a shot at doing a man filling out of that template, then that'll help to contextualize this question among the others that we're asking.
Yeah. And then in the three little questions the three big questions that Aliza asked, I gave some very sort of high-level answers. But I will put it into the template.
That'll help us to figure where the holes are. Thank you. Any other questions for Megan on this issue? All right, thank you. You want to go ahead on the string confusion?
Yeah, I'll do string confusion as well. And again, this is extraordinarily confusing. I just can't believe the results. I've looked at a whole series of outcomes from the panels on string confusion, a string similarity, and string confusion objection, and they come right down the line, approximately. Now I'm exaggerating a bit to make a point. About half of them say there's no confusion, and about half say there is confusion. So about half found in favor of the applicant, and about half found in favor of the objector. And in the vast majority of cases, they were singular and plural questions, the ones I'm looking at primarily. Now, how you can find confusability in a plural in one case and not in another is quite interesting. So I don't know if it's the process that didn't work, or I find it very hard to believe that one plural is not confusing and another plural is confusing. That just doesn't make any sense to me.
Now, I think you're not alone in that.
So it will be interesting to try to fill the template out on that one. But I think string confusability is one of the most confusing issues that we have to deal with. It's not at all clear. And I can understand why some of the applicants are quite grumpy about this.
And are the answers simply binary, Megan, or is there any explanatory text around why they were found while serving?
Yeah, there's lots of text. Each one of the panels has, the stream confusion panels have published their results, and sometimes they're up to 20 pages long. Sometimes they're only 3 or 4 pages. It just depends. Each case is different. the logic is not consistent, let me put it that way. And I think it seems to have depended on who the panel member was and what the panel member decided. That really seems to be the case. Which isn't a very good observation on the future, quite frankly.
So how do we get to the next step of that, of trying to I'm just trying to think if it just feels logical that it should be confusing in one case and not another. I'm just trying to wonder if there's anything to, any way to delve further into that.
Exactly. Well, I think that's where we could, and here I need David's help on this, because David was supposed to join me in this one, but he's been away on holiday. And he has a much better feel for some of these cases, I'm sure. I think where we could do some useful work here on the shrinking is to make some clear recommendations for the future on confusability, on prior rights, in other words, something that already exists in the route that's already been delegated, can't be applied for in plural, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the question is to establish now some clear rules on this. And that will avoid, I mean, already there's a lot of water under the bridge, but by establishing some new rules, or clear rules at least, that will perhaps help to clarify things in the future, in future delegations, because I'm not supposed to say rounds.
Okay. Lorraine, go ahead.
You know, Megan's discussion about the lack of consistency, I think, raises the big issue and related issue about the reconsideration process in general, which, as you know, I'm still trying to get my brain around what our task is and what data we're looking at. But I do know that there were several emails exchanged, I think, starting with Drew, but then there was a lot of interest, and it's certainly a topic I think deserves some attention for all our radar screens about the reconsideration process in general and issues of consistency. And I think we see that played out perhaps most publicly in the community application process. And I just want to make sure that the community application process and the independent review panels and reconsideration processes related to that are something that we're going to devote some more focused attention and consideration to, because I know that it's a topic of community interest. It's something we should be looking at as well.
Hi, Lorraine. Although when we went through and prioritized, we sort of deprioritized looking at these different types of applicants and kind of kicked that can down the road to the PDP. So it's not entirely clear to me that a deep dive into the community application process was something that we all agreed was part of our remit. I think we'll get at some hints of that, but that would have to be a pretty affirmative decision to go forward to try and dive deeply into that particular issue.
I'm sorry, Jonathan. I probably misremembered that then.
But just on that point of reconsideration, sorry to jump in on this one. I think it's an important factor in the reconsideration request, because the community applications are certainly a factor to be taken into consideration in the contention set. That's certainly a factor that's been raised a few times. And so I don't think we can ignore it entirely. On the other hand, I agree we shouldn't delve into it in too much detail, but it certainly has arisen, and it certainly could be addressed in some way. I think we can't do the full Monty, as it were, the full analysis, because the Ombudsman has already done a full analysis of the process. But I think there are cases that have arisen in that context and should identify it.
Maybe I can jump in here. I have to tell you that.
Your voice is faded off.
I hope you hear me better now. I want to jump in about the community application process, because certainly from the at-large perspective, there is an umbilical connection between the reconsideration and the community application process. From our community especially, has been great concern that the way community was defined, and I have specific examples here from my side of the world, it tended to disallow several actors who were thinking of participating and see themselves as community, albeit not one as defined in the application process. So I think there's a connection between that and the reconsiderations. If you look at the reconsideration applications, they are connected to those who think they're slighted because they're community type applications. Definitely those are the ones that have been loudest, if not in the majority, but they've certainly been loudest. And I don't see how we could not have a look at this. So I just put it out there.
Thanks, Carlton. We may need to explore further, and we probably don't have time in this call, but very shortly, about how we're going to go about looking at that question if we're going to look at it. But Jordan, you've got your hand up.
Yeah, I was just going to say, so I agree with both Megan and Carlton that it's impossible to look at the reconsideration process without, or the sort of pain points felt by applicants as expressed through the reconsideration process without grappling at least somewhat with the community question, in that there's a lot of reconsideration requests that revolve around community decision making. At the same time, Jonathan, I totally agree with you that we made a conscious decision to sort of mostly move this discussion about different types of applicants to the PDP. And I think that is one of the topics that the PDP is actively engaging in. So my guess is we probably just want to provide some information in sort of the form of our findings, which will probably echo roughly what Carlton says, which is, you know, there's a lot of confusion and perhaps incorrect definition around communities that led to a lot of pain. But I think it will be the recommendation side of that is probably a lot more likely to come from the PDP process.
Thanks, Ron. So we're looking at community via the reconsideration process, and try and make some general findings, I guess, and then the recommendations, if any, are going to be think about clarification and probably get kicked to the PDP. So we just need to look at setting some boundaries on that discussion about community. And keep it in the context of the reconsideration process to the extent that we can. Carlton, I'm going to connect with you offline about how to proceed on that particular question. Those look like they're old hands. So with the last few minutes here, I'm going to hand the mic over to Jordan to talk a little bit about rounds.
Sure. So I sent out an email to everyone yesterday with rough thoughts. And just to caveat up front, somewhat one-sided thoughts. I think we agreed previously that I was going to put together the sort of bullet points that explain why rounds don't work. We don't have the defensive rounds included here, so maybe someone who better understands that set of arguments. I could probably try to do a straw man of the defense, but I don't think it would be very good because I don't, so far I haven't found those arguments very persuasive, so I'm not sure I would do a good job of recreating them. But in short, I think the most of the bullet points that I put together revolve around the decontention process. Community is actually one example of that. But the core of the problem seemed, in my mind at least, is that if you allow a round, if you have a process that works with rounds, then you allow more than one applicant for the same TLD to apply during that round, and then you have to decide which of the worthy applicants get it. There's an easy process by which, if they fail the evaluation process, that's an easy way to break ties. But in reality, very, very few, I think something approaching none of the TLD applicants actually failed the evaluation process. A few were filtered out through the objection process. In the vast majority of cases, if multiple applicants apply for the same TLD, eventually we'll have to decide who gets it. And the ICANN process gives priority to communities. That's the only sort of tiebreaker that's included. And we've sort of talked about the problems. We just hinted at the problems related to the community process. So I think there were a lot of disputes, obviously, around that process. It created quite a lot of hand-wringing within ICANN. You saw probably what people would consider relatively good faith communities getting denied, and then you also saw people trying to game the system by trying to sort of stretch the definition of community so that they would have priority. So both of those sort of resulted in, I think, non-optimal outcomes because of the way that community was defined or the way that people tried to jump into it. If you have the sort of last resort process, if you do have more than one applicant to fall back to, is the ICANN auction. And ICANN auctions create their own set of both headaches and opportunities, I guess. But ICANN gets a lot of money. In the case of .web, they just got $135 million. And then we have to decide what to do with that money. And ICANN's not really designed to be an organization that disperses hundreds of millions of dollars of proceeds. So in some ways, it's a good problem to have. In other ways, it sort of stretches the mission of ICANN. That's something of a distraction from its sort of core competencies. The second point I raised, other than sort of the problems with this decontention process, are that the rounds really decrease the predictability of the process. So, for example, if you, and this is true for both applicants, there's sort of obvious reasons for applicants. If you're an applicant and you apply, you don't know whether you're actually going to get the TLD or not. It's hard to sort of make business plans around it. Similarly, because of the contention process above, almost all of the TLDs that still aren't delegated at this point aren't delegated as a result of tie-ups in the contention process, so that slows things down. But from the flip side, if you're someone who's concerned about a particular application, you might have to waste a lot of resources maybe objecting to it or tracking it or something like that, even though, in the example of GmbH that Megan raised earlier, it might be that a government or something has concerns about the approach that a particular applicant or set of applicants is taking, but they might be fine with what other applicants are doing. But because the government doesn't know which of those applications will be successful, they have to take action against the ones or related to the ones that that they have problems with, even though those might eventually be unsuccessful in any case. And so there's a lack of predictability for those that have either public interest or commercial interests or other types of interests related to applicants as third parties, that makes things more complicated as well. Whereas if you just sort of, if an application was lodged and you knew that that would be the applicant that would get the TLD if it was successful, then you would be able to be more predictable about whether you needed to take action or not. And then the third point I raised is that the rounds might encourage speculative applications. There's some people, I think, have said that they only applied because they thought they wouldn't be able to apply again for a long time. And that's obviously, we see, I think some of the analysis we're seeing from the Competition and Consumer Choice team, is there's a large number of TLDs that either haven't been delegated or have very few registrations in them. It may be that some of those are speculative in nature and weren't really intended to do anything useful, and that seems like a high cost to the program. So those are the downsides I identified for rounds. I think each of these we could probably add some data around if for example, in point number one, we could probably around the community and the decontention process, we could probably look at the reconsideration requests to sort of point out that these were between community and just general decontention process. I think that was the majority of the reconsideration requests that were filed. On the predictability side, we could probably look at timelines. We could probably look at objections that were filed that against applicants that weren't successful anyways. And then in the third case, we might just have to get that from some of the applicant surveys. But, people sort of, if I've identified the right sort of high-level bullet points, I think the next thing to do would actually be to say, how do we verify that this is, how do we take this hypothesis and say this isn't just Jordan's speculation, but is substantiated by data?
That's definitely the next step. And I guess the question is that there's also this notion about whether there's a direct link between, because rounds and contentions. In other words, if it's a, I guess embedded in this is the assumption that the fact that we had multiple applications for the same string was a function of rounds. And what you're suggesting as an alternative is first come, first serve approach instead. Am I reading that correctly?
Yes, I think that's right. If you don't have rounds, I don't think there's any mechanism other than first come, first serve. I guess you could say if someone applies, that starts a timer where there's a period of time in which someone else can jump in and apply instead. I don't know of any parallel processes that work like that, so that would be unusual, I guess. We do have, on the flip side, objection processes. So if someone applies and you don't like it for some reason, it violates your rights or there's public interest concerns, there's ways to express that through an objection process. But, yes, I would imagine that if you didn't have rounds, first come, first serve would be the allocation mechanism.
Yeah, I guess it's just important to capture that notion that you can't end up with, if the real issue is contentions like that, then you can't end up with a process, a non-round-based process that still gets you to those contentions. So, I mean, the real issue is the simultaneous nature of the applications, I suppose, more so than the fact that it's a round.
If you didn't have rounds, you did allow for simultaneous application somehow. I don't understand that mechanism. You still might resolve my third bullet about speculative applications.
Right.
But most of the other two bullets will still apply, I think.
Okay, so let's give some thought on how we go about putting some meat on the bones of this in terms of evidence. I may try to follow up with you directly on that, Jordan. Elisa, before we get going, though, is there Do you feel like there's a question in the survey, and I'm just trying to remember, that deals with question three? Obviously, we don't want to call it speculative, but did you feel pressure to apply before you were ready because of the deadline? Is there any question like that?
Sorry, I was muted. So there are questions related to why you applied, but not. I don't think it quite gets at that topic.
So maybe we can try to just take a shot, since we're just about to field a survey that deals directly with applicants, to see if the notion of not knowing when you would be able to apply next was a high motivation.
I need to see if this call's going to end.
Okay.
Okay.
And we can try to come up with what wording for that might look like.
Realize
we're on a tight time frame.
There's a few questions that, you know, ask about whether you received sufficient guidance from ICANN during the application process about challenges you face. So maybe we could build something into that section. And there is also a question that has to do with whether or not you think rounds are the appropriate mechanism. And there's an open text box there on what you do or you don't. So there's that. And I'd welcome anyone to take a look at those questions again, and if you have suggestions for an added question or refining those questions on that topic, we could make some changes.
Elisa, sure. And I'll try to think a little
bit
about
that
with this.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Thanks, guys. I guess this, I wonder if this is an issue of coordination with the PDP folks, because I know that Jeff, in particular, has some view about rounds. Just worried about this being open-ended, but I wonder if we don't have anybody that's a fan of rounds on our review team, if we should, get help with that straw man.
Hey, Jonathan, it's Jordan. Yeah, I think at the very least it would be good to understand the hypothesis in favor of rounds, so we could try to collect data on that as well.
Right. All right. Well, let's make an action item to reach out to Jeff on that question. Okay. Any other questions for Jordan? All right, folks, thank you. We've got a lot of work to do. Let's get on it. And Alice, I'll probably follow back up with you to help me put together my to-do list from the last two calls and make sure that nothing falls between the cracks.
Sounds great. Thanks.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, everyone.
Bye. Thank you. Bye.